This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This is the Get Booked Podcast, a weekly show for personalized reading recommendations. This is episode 322, and we are recording on March 15th. This is our first post-daylight savings time change recording, so buckle up. I'm Jen Northington. I'm here with Amanda Nelson, and we're coming to you from Book Riot, and I don't know what time it is.
It doesn't matter. Time has no meaning.
I mean, it's true that time has no meaning, but my body thinks it's important. So
I've had an interesting, this is the first year where daylight savings time has meant that my children get up after me, which has never happened in my life. But like, I get up at six or whatever, and the kids are sleeping until like seven because of daylight savings time. And so I just kind of don't know what to do. The dog is also very confused. Like, he's wandering around the house. Like, he'll sit at the foot of the stairs like, where the fuck? I'm usually playing right now. Like, there's ball. There's like tug. Where are my people? He just wanders around looking very sad.
Right.
Oh, sorry. Did I have
It's fine.
Yeah. So that's what's happening now. I'm sitting on my couch not knowing what to do with my hand eyes because my children are sleeping.
That's funny. That's funny. I think I have a lot of friends with toddlers who are having the reverse situation right now.
I mean, they're almost 11, so it took a decade before this wasn't the worst day of my life.
I was just going to say, our condolences to everyone with a child who is dealing with, and with cats who demand food at ungodly hours. Our condolences to everyone. Okay. All right. Here we go. So how does this show work when we're not ranting about time change? I will tell you, it is, in fact, a show for personalized reading recommendations. You can send in your reading request. It can be maybe you have a certain kind of book you love you're having trouble finding. Maybe you need a recommendation for a friend or relative or for your book club or for travel or for vacation or for hiding from the world or whatever. And you can send those in either via email, getbooked@bookriot.com. Or there's a form in the show notes over on the Book Riot site. For every episode, you can drop your request in there. If it is a time-sensitive request you're hoping to hear back by a certain date, please put all caps, time-sensitive, and then the date you're hoping to hear back by, either in the subject line of the email or the very first line of the form. We don't get to all of them, but we get to as many as we can. That's my story. All right, let's see. Let's do some feedback from another Amanda. Who has two recommendations for Ray, who wanted books in the Caribbean. The novels Float Plan by Trish Dollar and Next Year in Havana by Chanel Cleeton. Float Plan is considered a contemporary romance, but it's more about the main character's journey living on a sailboat and sailing around the various islands while working through some personal grief, strong sense of place on the sailboat and Caribbean islands, and camaraderie around the sailboat community. Next Year in Havana takes place in Cuba and Miami. It's told in dual timelines based on the author's family stories and conveys a strong sense of place for life in Cuba in both eras. Interesting. Okay, and from Alice, for the listener who just wants to party with an Ocean 11 feel, I recommend Ellie Casamano's Finlay Donovan is Killing It and the sequel Finlay Donovan Knocks Him Dead, where a divorced mother who writes suspense romance accidentally becomes a hit woman.
What?
It made me laugh so hard and loud on an airplane, people literally turned to stare at me. I also recommend anything from Jonas Jonasson. He is most known for The 100-Year-Old Man Who Jumped Out the Window Disappeared, which is indeed hilarious. But if you want the crime vibe, maybe grab Hitman Anders and The Meaning of It All or Sweet, Sweet Revenge, LTD. What titles those are. I've been hearing about Finlay Donovan. And nobody had actually told me what they were before, and now I definitely have to read them.
Yeah, as a divorced mother who is also a hitman. No, I'm just kidding.
Right, I was just going to say, Amanda, it's your story. Who told them?
Who do I need to sue?
All right, well, Amanda's going to read our first question, and then we will recommend some books.
All right, question one is from Sue, who says, I just had a sweet small book club meeting with my 10-year-old niece and my sister. We discussed Trevor Noah's Born a Crime. They read the kids' version together, and I read the adult version. It was so fun to do with my niece. We're now looking for another book and want to expand our club to the rest of our family, including my 80-year-old parents. So, the club will include a 10-year-old who prefers fiction. She just told me her favorite series is Small Spaces by Katherine Arden. I gave her The Lotteries a while back, and she liked that. She liked Born a Crime, so I know she can get into memoirs. I think the humor in the face of horrible situations was one thing she appreciated about the book. I love sci-fi fantasy, anything with time travel. My parents also prefer fiction. My mom loved A Gentleman in Moscow. Let's see, my other niece is in college, so doesn't have a lot of time for fun reading. So something on the shorter side would be best. Okay, any suggestion for a family-friendly book club would be much appreciated, i.e. no sex, no swearing. COVID willing, we'll all be getting together mid-June for discussion. Okay, let's hear from our first sponsor.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
Alrighty, family book club. This is tough. This one's tough. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find a book that that a 10-year-old and an 80-year-old will appreciate. Actually, I think the college student part is the hardest part about that. That's the hardest part. So anyway, I picked The Birchbark House by Louise Erdrich, which is a children's book. It's like middle grade, so the 10-year-old will have no problem with it. But I picked this because it has big Little House on the Prairie vibes. And so that is a thing that I think the older folks, especially your parents who are in their 80s, will connect to the kind of nostalgic sort of sepia tone of the book. And then there's a lot to talk about there because you can discuss the ways in which it is not Little House on the Prairie, of which there are many. First of all, Louise Erdrich is an Indigenous writer, and this is a book about an Indigenous character. So it's about a little girl named Omakayas. She is 7, and she is found on an island in Lake Superior called Madeline Island. She's the only survivor of a smallpox outbreak that kills her family and everybody in her village. So she's found by a woman named Tallow and taken into another Ojibwa family and is raised there. And the book follows the family through her point of view through a cycle of all four seasons in 1847 when smallpox comes back and takes over the island. And this is a real thing that happened. So it's a historically documented event. Louise Erdrich did a lot of research about it. She talked to a lot of members, a lot of elders from the Ojibwa tribe about the history of Madeline Island, people who still live there. She read letters from people who had traveled there and went with her, her own family to the island and spent some time there, especially so she could watch her little kids interact with the natural environment of the island and then kind of use that to model the character. So it's got that kind of you know, a family surviving with their wits and whatever they can hunt or catch or whatever, kind of thing that Little House on the Prairie has. So there's a lot of that to talk about. But of course, it's lacking like the racism and the colonialism, which is always a nice bonus. And if you've got, you know, a 10-year-old, I'm thinking about my kids who are 10 and the kind of stuff that they're starting to learn about in like history class, like Christopher Columbus and all of that kind of stuff. Like their school is pretty good about putting that all in the correct context, like their correct historical context. But a lot of schools aren't. And so there might be something there that you can use to talk about with the little kids about, you know, what they're learning in school and maybe even the college student, because maybe she didn't get like what the experience of like Little House on the Prairie actually was for a lot of the people who already lived there when the Ingalls family showed up. So that is The Birch Bark House by Louise Erdrich.
Yeah, this was tricky, and I agree. It's I feel like it's less hard to do the extreme ends and more hard to shoot for the middle that's going to work for the littles. So I picked Tide Song by Wendy Hsu, which is a graphic novel. So extremely readable for your college student and the 10-year-old. And it is a family story that has three generations, well, a bunch of relatives in it. There's Sophie, who is the young witch, who is the center of our story. And her mother and grandmother are very excited about her attending the best magic school in the realm, even though she's like not that great at magic sometimes. And there are exams, so they send her to go live with her great aunt and her cousin to train for the exams. And that like also does not go great. Sophie ends up befriending a water dragon. And, you know, it is very much like a story of like figuring out how to be you and like how do you navigate family pressure and school pressure and, you know, things that are going to be accessible to the 10-year-old, but also I think relatable for everyone. And I thought the fun part of this discussion would be like visiting, like obviously you're seeing this through Sophie's perspective, but there's several generations represented in this book. So, and there are several generations in your family. So like y'all could talk about like, you know, were mom and grandma right? Were they wrong? Like, what would you have done in their place? Like you could do some, you know, generational discussions around that stuff could be fun. And it, like I said, it'll be easy and quick for everybody to read. You can talk about the art. Like it'll be a fun experience, I think, for everyone. It's definitely more low key than Born a Crime. But I love Wendy Hsu's work and I thought this would be an awesome option. So again, that's Tide Song by Wendy Hsu. All right, our next question is from D. Oh, who sent us cat pictures? Side note, thank you. Thank you very much, D. They were appreciated. We will accept any and all pet pictures. Okay, so D says, my partner and I have been trying to live more sustainably for a while now, but one thing I've never been able to do is grow my own food. I'm looking for a good intro book for someone interested in growing or at least starting to grow their own food with limited resources. I don't have a garden. And some tips on which plants are best grown where, etc. How to keep on top of the planting, watering, fertilizing, harvesting cycles. I have zero experience, so something very basic and good for beginners would be best. I'm thinking of starting small, like maybe replanting green onions and lettuces or growing cherry tomatoes. I'd appreciate any help you can offer. I'm just going to keep going. This is a request near and dear to my heart. And I'm going to give you my favorite basic, like, good comprehensive reference, which is the all-new Square Foot Gardening. The third edition is the one you want. It's the most recent one by Mel Bartholomew and the Square Foot Gardening Foundation. Literally, all you need to grow some stuff is a square foot of dirt. Like, that's it. That's all you need. So if you are in an apartment situation or you have, like, very limited outside space that does not include, like, you can plant things in the ground, which, side note, if you're in an urban area, you might not want to do anyway because there are chemicals in your ground that you do not want in your food. So just FYI, put it in a pot. Get a pot that's a square foot or build one. That there are literally instructions in this book for how to build your own containers if you so desire. And this is great because there's beautiful pictures that it walks you step by step through, like, okay, where do you get seeds? What can you replant? Do you need to put things inside or can they be outside? Like, how often do you have to water? What grows when? All of these things are in here. The one caveat I always have with this book is they make a big deal about using what they call Mel's Mix, which is like this very specific soil mix composition that's supposed to like help you have to do less weeding and like water differently. And like, okay, fine. Like if you really want to go and like do the Mills mix thing, I don't know if this stuff is available in the UK. D notes that, you know, you're in the UK. So like maybe this stuff is available. Maybe it's not. Just use dirt. Just use dirt. Just get dirt from like Home Depot or whatever the UK equivalent is. You're fine. Compost is helpful though. But yeah, it'll talk you through everything. And it'll also, I love how they have sample gardens planning and show you like the different things that you could grow in combination that would go good together, which is something I had like definitely never thought consciously about, but is actually super helpful when you're trying to grow things that you're actually going to want to eat. Because man, growing something that then you're like, I don't actually want to eat that is a real bummer. So yeah, that is the all new Squarefoot Gardening by Mel Bartholomew and the Squarefoot Gardening Foundation. Go forth, let us know how it goes.
So I picked Apartment Gardening, Plants, Projects, and Recipes for Growing Food in Your Urban Home by Amy Pennington and Kate Bingaman Burt. This is a book from an author that lives in Seattle. So I picked it because that is a pretty similar climate to where you are, probably in the UK. So a lot of the advice that she has will be, you know, kind of easily transferable to your living situation. All that is required to follow the instructions or the advice here is two windows in your space. So as long as you've got two windows with like sills that you can put stuff in, then you will be able to grow various and sundry items. It's very, very like uber beginner. Here's where you find a plant pot, you know, kind of stuff. And it does start with the easy to recognize grocery store items that a lot of people who don't have a ton of space or any space to do outdoor gardening will want to start with. So like you mentioned with re-sprouting green onions, which you can do by just sticking in a mason jar of water and putting them in your windowsill, or growing an herb garden, things like that. She does have some suggestions for like if you've got a deck, but if you don't, you don't need to follow those. And there are also suggestions for if you have like a strip in between your houses, like any taking advantage of any little piece of available growable space. And if you can't use those things, then just like Jen said, using pots. But it does start super easy with like all the stuff you're going to be able to find in the grocery store. You should not really have to go to like any kind of specialty home and garden center to start with most of these things. And then it does advance from there. So there are some lesser known vegetables or fruits or things that you can grow a little bit more kind of 102 level apartment gardening. But the assumption that this book has is that one, you don't know what you're doing. And two, you don't have anywhere to do it. And then that's where it builds from, which is super helpful. So that's Apartment Gardening by Amy Pennington and Kate Bingaman Burt. All right. Question three is from Kim, who says, I really enjoy urban fantasy books, but I realize I'm always the most interested in a lot of the mundane parts. I like to see werewolves at the bank or witches buying their ingredients at Walmart. Something maybe along the lines of What We Do in the Shadows would be great. I also really like the vibes of the Beetlejuice waiting room scene or the movie Risk Cutters, where the characters have crappy jobs in the afterlife. There can definitely be action, but I would really love a big focus to be on the characters' day-to-day life. All right, Jen, what you got?
All right, I picked, it's more science fiction. I mean, it is science fiction. It's not more science fiction than fantasy. It is science fiction, but it's exactly what you're talking about. It's A Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers. This is the first in a new novella series, the Monk and Robot series from Chambers, which I am a big fan of. Make sure you have tea in the house, by the way, when you start this book. You're going to want some. So it is about a tea monk, which is just a cool job. Like, I would like to have that job, please and thank you. In this future where there is, you know, humanity has like reached a peak of crisis and come back from it and have figured out how to live sustainably. They've also like carved out huge areas of their planet where they do not go. And sentient AI has also happened. So like all of the robots live in the areas where the humans don't go and humans don't really interact with the wild robots. And our main character, the tea monk, is sort of facing some like career burnout, for lack of a better word, like trying to figure out like what they want to do with themselves. Like they switched jobs a couple of times. They're still not satisfied. They're like, maybe I need to go like out into the world and have an adventure, which they do. But it's so much about like, yeah, moving through your day to day. But all of the context of that day to day is science fictional, which is exactly what you're talking about. I too love that. It's a really cool, like, oh yeah, how would I do that if I lived in this scenario or if these things were possible? Like, what would that be like? It's pretty awesome. So this is a very, it's less like It's not really funny. Like, a lot of the things you referenced are very, very funny. This is not a funny book, but it is extremely heartwarming and very, like, yes, quietly day to day. And I think you'll really love it. I'm really excited for the next installment in this series to happen. So again, that's A Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers.
All right. I picked The House in the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Klune, which has the most possible mundane premise, which is a dude who works for like a small government bureaucracy. So Linus is the main character. He is 40. He lives in a house by himself with a cat and a grumpy neighbor. The universe in which he lives is magical, and he is not. He's a very like normal dude. His job is as a caseworker at the department in charge of magical youth. So it's his job to oversee the like life, essentially, of children who are in foster care in this kind of universe or government-sanctioned care homes, like orphanages, functionally. The rub here is that all of these children are magical. So they, once a kid comes, like, is revealed to be magical in some way, they're usually placed in some sort of care home or care facility for their own safety, quote unquote. And then he works for what is functionally magical social services to oversee their care. He gets summoned by his bosses, like the management, and is given a job that's kind of weird, to travel to an island orphanage where a man named Arthur is the caretaker, and he is in charge of a series of pretty dangerous children. There's a were-Pomeranian, which is my favorite character of any book ever in the history of the world. Also a sprite, there's a wyvern, and the Antichrist, like the actual Antichrist, lives in this orphanage. And he's not given a lot of details about what he's supposed to do when he gets there, except like watch and report back. And that's kind of it. And so he gets there and he's a very by the book kind of dude, you know, goes and like sets up shop and is paying attention to what's going on. He realizes pretty quickly that there's something weird about this situation. Both his assignment and Arthur, the dude that he is like essentially supposed to be spying on. There's some romance, many, many kissings, but a lot of it is just like bureaucratic stuff. Like, I'm filling out this report, or I'm going to talk to my boss, or like, I'm eating dinner next to the were-Pomeranian, and oops, he transformed into his dog form, and like, now I need to clean up this chicken he spilled. You know, it's like very, especially if you have any experience with children, like living or working with children, that just kind of day-to-day cleaning up messes, dealing with tantrums, wiping noses, the nose just might be attached to the Antichrist kind of a thing. So it's very mundane, but like very sweet and heartwarming. So that's The House in the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Klune.
All right. Our next question is from Amy, who says, I recently read The Haunting of Maddie Clare, and I loved the romance mixed in with the ghost story. I'm looking for another horror/supernatural mixed in with a romance, my two favorite genres, but please no books where the characters get it on with ghosts. Amy, I have to tell you that you said that, and then all I could think of were books where
yeah,
the characters get it on with ghosts. So I had to get some help. I went to the contributors for some help. And we came up with The Widow of Rose House by Diana Biller, which I think looks perfect, side note, and has like rave reviews from a lot of people, including Smart Bitches Trashy Books, who know from romance. It's set in Gilded Age New York, late 1800s. The main character, Alva Webster. Oh, content warning, domestic abuse. Okay. So, yes, the main character, Alva, is just like barely starting to re-enter her home in society. She left an abusive marriage and her husband has since died. And so she's like, okay, I'm going to go back home. I'm going to re-enter society. Hopefully they'll like take me back because it was very scandalous that I fled, even though like obviously she is not in the wrong here. But it turns out that this dilapidated Hyde Park mansion that she's staying in is haunted. Whoops. And so she has to bring in the Professor Samuel Mower, who is convention flouting and scandalous, just what she doesn't need. Also catching some feelings here. They do some ghost hunting, also many kissings. Like, here you go. Here you go. I think you're going to enjoy it. It looks really perfect for what you're looking for. It's on my library holds list now. And again, that's The Widow of Rose House by Diana Biller.
All right, I picked Empire of Wild by Cherie Dimaline, which was blurbed to me or described to me as a really screwed up adult Little Red Riding Hood if Little Red Riding Hood and the wolf were married. And that is basically what it is. So the main character's name is Joan. Her husband, Victor, has been missing for almost a year. They had a big argument. She inherited some tribal land from, I think, her grandfather that they've been living on, and he wants to sell it and, like, move or whatever, but she's against it, etc. Just one of those, like, marital arguments, right? And so he stormed out in the middle of the argument and then never came home, and he's been gone for months and months and months. And so she has been searching for him really desperately, not turning anything up. She's starting to, you know, her friends and family are starting to be like, this is, he's not coming back. Like, you've been left, you know, like, let's, it's time to start moving on. But then she ends up in a Walmart parking lot through a series of events one morning. And there's a revival happening in the Walmart parking lot, like an old school kind of tent revival. And she wanders in because she's been hearing about these tent revivals that are targeting Métis people, like her specific indigenous community. So she goes in to kind of see what all the fuss is about. And the preacher, whose name is Eugene Wolf, is there trying to convert Métis people to Christianity, except Eugene Wolf is her husband. And so, of course, she goes, she approaches him and is like, what the hell? Like, you've been gone for a year. You're not pretending to be some preacher. Like, what's wrong with you? And he legitimately has no idea who she is. Like, he has cut his hair. You know, he's wearing a suit. He's doing this whole preacher thing. And he does not remember her at all. Okay. He's also a werewolf. So, like, that's the thing that's going on here, is that when he left her in the middle of their fight, he got taken by a roguru, which in traditional Métis stories is a werewolf-like figure. And so she figures this out, that this is why he was gone, this is why he doesn't remember her. And then she teams up with her 12-year-old nephew, whose name is Zeus. He's obsessed with Johnny Cash. He's amazing. And Ajin, who is an elder, who is like a euchre shark. She's also amazing. These are just very, quirky is not the right word, but like memorable side characters who team up with Joan to help her get her husband back and save him from his fate of becoming and remaining a werewolf forever. So there is a romance, but it's not like the book is not a romance. It's like not classified as a romance at all, but it is, I think, a kind of a romance novel, because it is a book about this relationship and the things they have to overcome to come back together. Just because they're not strangers when they meet doesn't mean the book is not a romance. Do you know what I mean? Like, just because they're already married doesn't mean that they don't have struggles and have to find each other again. Especially because, like, the whole thing is a metaphor for, like, the patriarchal issues that Métis women have to deal with and have always had to deal with. So, like, there's a lot going on here. It's really complex, but also really easy to read, very engrossing. So that's Empire of Wild by Cherie Demeling. And it is time for our next sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must-read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeeBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
And now it is time for me to talk again. So question five is from Becky, who says, I read a big variety of books, but I find myself getting into a rut sometimes when I keep reading the next book in a series. Can you recommend a book for me that is a standalone that has never been recommended on the show before? This was
rough. Gauntlet Throne.
I know. Jen, you go.
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I have been keeping a book in my pocket for specifically this kind of situation. Ooh. It is The Memory Librarian by Janelle Monáe, Yohanka Delgado, Eve L. Ewing, Elia Don Johnson, Danny Lohr, and Cherie Renee Thomas. Yes, the Janelle Monáe. It is it's a linked short story collection, and it does technically take place in the world of Dirty Computer, which is an album you might recall. It's kind of a big deal. Mm. But you don't have to have seen that or know anything about Monet's music to appreciate this. I don't think it stands perfectly alone, although obviously you should go watch Dirty Computer.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm just saying 100%. To you, watch the visual and the album. It's amazing. But yeah, this is sci-fi. It is really interesting. It's a really interesting collection because each story does feel of a piece, but they go in really interesting directions. I will give some content warnings now before I start talking about any specifics for transphobia, unjust incarceration, racism, and homophobia. There's one story that opens that I think was my favorite, no shade to the others, but this one was just so powerful, about a woman who is a memory librarian, and who, like, what that means is that she's constantly surveilling the memories of the populace when you, like, you go to these, like, ATMs, basically, and upload your memories and you get money. Why, who wouldn't want that? And they use this to surveil. Like, it's pretty sinister. Mm. And she, like, entered the system to try to do good from the inside. And she has this chance encounter with another woman who she starts falling for and, like, who brings her into this underground situation. And she starts to have to question whether or not it's even possible to do the good that she thought she was doing in these circumstances. And, you know, some of the other stories also, I mean, they're all really powerful. There's one about a couple who move into an apartment and they figure out that time moves differently in a closet in the apartment. And, like, what do you do with that? Like, it's a fascinating thought experiment. And there's so much of that in here. So I felt like this was, I mean, you said whatever, just as long as it hadn't been recommended. But I think this is the kind of thing where each story you're going to want to sit there and be like, oh, yeah, like, let me think about that. There's a lot to chew on. The characters are great. The writing is great. It's a really amazing collection. And I so appreciate all of the authors who are involved in this. So again, that is The Memory Librarian and Other Stories of Dirty Computer.
This took me forever. I had to go back through our old spreadsheets. Yeah. Every time I thought of a book, I was like, I'm pretty sure I've not talked about this. Inevitably, I talked about it once in like 2017 and then have just forgotten. So this took me forever. But I found one that I really like. It's Waiting for Tomorrow by Natacha Apana, and it's translated by Jeffrey Strachan. And this is a French novel. The author is Mauritian and French. And it's about a woman named Anita, who, when the book opens, is waiting for her husband, Adam, to be released from prison. So you know that, like, as you're going in, that some stuff has happened. And then you go back in time to when they first met, which was at a New Year's Eve party in Paris. They fall in love. They both feel like outsiders. Quite literally, Anita is an immigrant from Mauritius, and Adam is in Paris from, like, the outskirts of, you know, like, the rural areas of France. So they feel ostracized, and that brings them together. They fall in love. They get married. They move to a village in southwestern France, and they have a baby named Laura. Adam abandons his dream of being a painter to become an architect to help support his family. Anita does the same thing. She wants to be a novelist. She kind of abandons that to get a freelance job for a local paper while she's also partially kind of staying home with their baby. And all of this kind of, you know, of everyday life starts to really wear on them, especially Anita. She starts to feel really stressed, like she's pulling more than her own, than like the fair amount of weight. So they hire Adele, who is an undocumented Mauritian immigrant, to be a nanny for Laura. And then everything starts falling apart after that. They both become a little obsessed with Adele for like different reasons. They both find themselves sparked creatively by her for different reasons. And so they both simultaneously want to go back to like, well, I want to quit being an architect and paint. Well, I want to quit working this freelance job and write a novel. And then like, who wins? Like, who gets, whose, you know, artistic life gets supremacy here is kind of is a big conflict. And then there's like, I mean, it falls apart to the point that you get back to the beginning where Adam's in jail, right? And Anita's waiting for him to get out. And I don't want to tell you what lands him in jail because it's kind of a spoiler. But it's such a, it's super short. It's not even like 200 pages, but it is such a fascinating examination of unequal labor and unequal respect for artistic endeavors in heterosexual long-term relationships. And this is a thing that, like, since COVID, people have been talking about, I think, more and more as we all ended up at home and then women had to leave the workforce at such greater rates than men to care for their kids. But this was written in 2015. Like, it was translated in English in 2018, but this was written way before that and is very much talking about that exact thing in French life, especially with that added intersection of being an immigrant. Adam is white and Anita is not, and that adds a whole other layer to what they're dealing with. So that's Waiting for Tomorrow by Natasha Apana.
Quick side note. The reason I haven't talked about the librarian, memory librarian before is in part because I thought it was out this month. It's actually not out until April 19th. So, like, you know, put in your pre-order now. Mm. I'm not going to take it back. I think it will work for
I'm
you.
Not going to take
you
it back.
You can wait. It's like 3 weeks away. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. All right. So our next question is from Laura, who says, I'm always on the lookout for more of my favorite thing, sassy ladies kicking ass and having romantical adventures in oldie times. My platonic ideal for this is Veronica Speedwell, but see also Lady Sherlock, Y.S. Lee's A Spy in the House, and Pride and Premeditation. Shout out to Tirza. Mm-hmm. I love a historical setting that takes me out of my own day-to-day and a character having agency over her career and romantic decisions. Bonus points for a series. I always want to spend as much time as possible with characters I love. Super bonus points for a setting that's not Victorian England and or a main character that's not a cis, hetero, white lady. Amanda.
Hello. All right. I love this kind of book, this like subgenre of anachronistic when somebody's like out of time, like anachronistically feminist women in like the Victorian era is just catnip to me. I love it so much. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And I picked a romance series for you. It's the Girl Meets Duke series. It's by Tessa Dare. The first book is called The Duchess Deal. And the books that you listed are not explicitly romances, and this one is. But I think it's really going to work because this is a series of romance novels where every book has a woman who, like, works. Except for, I think, one, who is a woman living in gentle poverty, like a noble woman living in gentle poverty. But in the first book, The Duchess Deal, the heroine is a seamstress. In the next one, the heroine is a Filipina governess. And they all encounter wealthy dudes who they have to, you know, have to, like, whatever. It's a romance novel. So, like, overcome obstacles, tussle with intellectually and not intellectually. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. but also these women are, like, kicking their own butts because they have to make their own livings. This in the same way that, like, Lady Sherlock has her own money, but until she doesn't, right? Until she gets ruined on purpose and then has to go out and work. The heroine in Y.S. Lee's stories works. The heroine in Pride and Premeditation is trying to work. Like, these are all women who are trying to make their own way. And the same is true for every book in this series by Tessa Dare. So I don't know if you want to, like, a summary of the first one, but in the first one, a seamstress who was a vicar's daughter and is now working for reasons that you get into, her name is Emma. She appears in the lobby of the home of a duke, the Duke of Ashbury, in a wedding dress. She's never met this man. And he's like, what's happening? And you find out very quickly that he was engaged. His wedding was canceled because he came back from the Napoleonic Wars really physically wounded. And his fiancée broke the wedding off because she thought he was ugly. And this seamstress, Emma, made the dress for the wedding. And since the wedding was canceled and the bride was a horrifying hell beast, she never got paid. But she can't afford that. Like, she can't afford to have done all this work for a duke's wedding to not get paid. So she shows up in the dress and is like, F you, pay me. Like, I am here. And if you don't pay me, I'm just going to sit here in this wedding dress. And what are you going to do about it? Nothing. nothing. And he's like, you're right. I'm not going to do anything about it. But I like you and I need a wife and you're in a wedding dress. This is convenient. And so he makes this deal with her that, you know, we'll get married. I need an heir. We'll do the things required to like make an heir and you can be a duchess for the rest of your life. But like once we get a child, we don't have to talk anymore. Like this is the thing that we need. This is the deal that we're making. And she's like, I don't know about that. Anyway, it's hilarious. Everybody is sassy, the Duke included. There's a lot of sass. There's a lot of adventure. There's a lot of wit and, you know, banter. It's great. So that's the Girl Meets Duke series by Tessa Dare.
All right. I just want to recommend you Jeannie Lynn, the amazing Jeannie Lynn, who has written a ton of historical romances. And I could pick, I mean, really, pick one. Pick it up. Read it. I will say that, okay, couple things. So, for example, the Tang Dynasty series, which I do love, is very much about what it meant to be a woman during the Tang Dynasty in China. And the strictures and, you know, like societal pressures around that and like how these women navigate that. It is not sassy. I don't think. It is much more about like, I am gonna find a way to do the thing, even though it is very hard and I will like wriggle my way into it, you know, through these strictures. Like I'm gonna make it work. And also love and kissing and swords, let's be honest, like the important things. And then you have like the Ping Kang Li mysteries, which are, you know, historical suspense, romantic suspense, and are all about solving crimes. And some of those heroines are working class. And those are also very much about like, yeah, what does it mean? Oh, excuse me, the Lotus Palace mysteries is what those are called. Regardless, it's very much about like, yeah, how do I navigate this world and like retain agency and a sense of self and also maybe fall in love. Like, how am I going to do those things? And I just love these books because they are so immersive. And like, you know, I don't think especially a lot of us Americans learned that much Chinese history. And so to get to be in that world and like experience what that is like for those characters is so cool. And I just love her characters. I love the romances, like all of it. Read them. Just read them. Just pick up some Jeannie Lynn. Like, you'll be fine. So yes, enjoy any of them. I don't care which one.
All right. Our last question is from Jess. This is my favorite question. I love this so much. Jess says, I'm looking for a book recommendation for my dad. He doesn't read frequently, but when he does, he usually rereads his favorite book, Don't Stop the Carnival by Herman Wouk. It's about a man who retires from his hectic job in New York to run a hotel on a remote Caribbean island, and naturally chaos ensues. I think this book speaks to my dad's aesthetic in general. He's basically Jimmy Buffett. I'd love for him to find other novels that he loves that have a similar theme or setting. He recently got divorced, so I'm looking for something that's not romance heavy. He also reads James Patterson and John Grisham, so crime thrillers are up his alley. All right. I sat here thinking about like, what would I recommend to Jimmy Buffett for like a really long time? It's so great. And I went with A Caribbean Mystery by Agatha Christie for a couple of reasons. First of all, obviously it's set in the Caribbean, so the setting will appeal to your father. Secondly, if your dad doesn't read a lot, Agatha Christie is the most book-selling author of all time. She has sold more books than any other person has sold books. So she appeals universally to most readers. So I think that, and like, they're short, you know, it's not going to be something he's going to have to slog through. And you said he liked crime. Obviously, this is crime. So this is a Miss Marple mystery. Miss Marple is an elderly woman who lives in the UK. She knits. She gets her nose in other people's business, and she solves murders. Like, this is what she does with her time. She's amazing. But her nephew, Raymond, has decided that she's like working too hard, you know, solving the mysteries. And so he wants to send her to a vacation at a resort in Saint Honoré in the Caribbean. And she's like, okay, I will just go knit there. That sounds fine. I don't care where I'm sitting when I'm knitting, as long as I'm sitting and knitting. So she goes to the Caribbean and interacts with some of the other guests, you know, in that very Agatha Christie setup where like you meet all the guests to kind of figure out who's going to die and who's doing the killing. And then she meets a colonel who turns out to be very obnoxious. He's just a windbag. Like, he tells all of these stories about his time in the war. Which war? Who knows? It doesn't matter. Just all of them. And he's kind of a like a blowhard. It's very self-congratulatory. And she's knitting and listening to him and being polite. And then he talks about how last time he was at this resort, he's pretty sure he witnessed a murder. Like, pretty sure. But he's also said a lot of other stuff that's unbelievable and kind of goofy. So she's only halfway listening to him. But while he's in the middle of this story, he gets a really weird look on his face. Like, he sees something. And then he starts talking about, like, that's the murderer, that's the murderer. And then he, like, runs off to his cabin before Miss Marple can figure out what in the heck he's talking about. And the next day he turns up dead, along with one of the members of the hotel staff. And so Miss Marple is off to, like, solve this crime. You know, it's pretty, it's I think, dismissed. I don't remember what I read it, but I think the local police immediately decide that it was, like, a robbery or something. But Miss Marple knows better. And so she goes off to solve this crime. The thing that I love about it is that she solves this murder mostly from the beach. Like, sitting on the beach, eavesdropping on people because she's an elderly woman and people don't consider elderly women to be humans. So, like, they just blab around her thinking there is no consequence that is going to be had because that's just an old woman who cares. But, of course, she, from her center of the beach, is in the middle of all the action and can pull strings like a spider in a web and eventually solves it, because of course she does, without even having to get up. She sits, she knits, she solves murders. I love her. So that's A Caribbean Mystery by Agatha Christie.
So many show titles today. I did not go the Caribbean route. I was thinking about, like, an older character, some criminess, you know, retired, like, off doing things. And so I'm going with a Get Book Chestnut, The Talented Ribkins by Lady Hubbard, because main character is 72 and he, like, he's just over everything for the most part. Except for that, he kind of sort of works for a mob boss and he kind of sort of stole some money. Whoops. And now he has a week to come up with the money. And good, lucky for him, he has these like bolt holes all around the south where he has buried some valuables. So he's like, okay, I'm going to go dig up my bolt holes and then I'll pay the mob guy back and I can go back to just being like an old kind of gray, you know, income person. But the first stop is at his deceased brother's house, where he finds out that he has this niece he didn't know he had. And the mother is like, you need to take her because this family, this African-American family, has like powers that manifest in very specific ways. Like, Johnny can draw a map to anything, whether or not he's been there. And that comes in very useful for crime, as you might expect, along with other more legit enterprises. And so his niece is manifesting powers. His mother's like, I don't know what to do about this, and you need to step up. He's like, well, I kind of have to go dig up some holes. And so the niece comes along with him on this road trip where they are being followed by mob boss flunkies. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on. It is so fun. There's some great, like, American civil rights history baked into it. I love the relationship between Johnny and his niece. And, like, it's just, it's a delightful read that also has, like, some heft to it in all of the ways that you want. And I think, like, anybody of that age would get a big kick out of it and really enjoy. And it's like, yeah, it's got the crimey stuff. It's fun. Just doesn't have the Caribbean vibe, but, you know, can't have everything in this world. So that's The Talented Ribkins by Lady Hubbard. And that's our show. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much to our audio editor, first and foremost, Jen Zink, for cleaning up all our sneezes and flubs and whatnot.
And thank F-bombs.
And F-bombs. Occasional F-bombs that we are not allowed to keep into the show. Whoops. Thank you all for listening. If you would like more book recommendations, you can have those. Go to bookriot.com. You can also find our other podcasts. We have a lot of them at bookriot.com/listen. If you would be so kind as to leave us a rating and or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podchaser, wherever. It does help other folks to find this show. And thanks go out to our sponsors for making the show possible. In between shows, you can find us on social media. Where is Amanda?
I'm on Instagram at I'm Amanda Nelson.
And you can find me on Twitter and Tumblr as Jen IRL, J-E-N-N-I-R-L, or on Instagram as I am Jen IRL. And we will talk to you next time.